A History of Holden Village. Conversations with Dr. Laverne Rieke. Recorded at the Kent, Washington home of Bill and Doris Dirks. Jane Rieke also being present. Vern was one of the early organizers of Holden, became the first president of the board, and continued in that capacity for several years. Now the official recorded history of Holden Village begins with the first national board meeting, May the 10th, 1961, in Seattle, Washington. Before that date, little was written about the early development of the village and events leading up to that first board meeting. And so Vern has graciously consented to give us his reflections of those early Holden days. In just a moment, we will begin the interview with Vern Rieke, first president of the Holden Village Corporation and Board.
Vern, we have this record here, and a lot of the minutes in the record would bear out a great many of the things since that time, but the record on the growth of Holden Village from those early days, that the Lutheran churches had control of the village, is very sparse. And so can you tell us what is your own involvement, how you first got involved in the whole thing of Holden Village?
It wasn't very hard, Bill. I was at home and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and one of the people from LBI, I don't remember whether it was Gil or whether it was Ed Autumn or possibly Vic Nelson, it would have been one of those three people, called me and asked whether or not I would be willing to meet with persons who were discussing the possibility of accepting this gift of land and what might be done with it. The background for that was the fact, as is well known, of course, that Wes Crieb had been writing to the mining company asking about their willingness to make a gift. And when they finally decided to make a gift, it came very suddenly, and with almost no discussion with anyone else. And when Wes finally learned that the land was available, the question was, to whom might the gift be made? Obviously, the mining company had to make the gift to someone that could accept it as a charitable organization for their purposes. And the Forest Department was unwilling to let the recipient be a group or a person that didn't conform to certain criteria that they had for managing the property. And those criteria really were of two kinds. One was the kind of program that would be operated out there. They didn't want certain kinds of activities going on in forest land, understandably. And the other thing was that they wanted to be sure that the group that accepted it would be able financially to maintain the property, protect against fires and other kinds of problems that would arise in that kind of a setting. The first approach had been made to the organized church bodies in this area to see whether or not they would be interested as organizations to take the property and operate some kind of a facility, and that had not received support for reasons which I suppose are not important at the moment, probably good ones. And then the suggestion was made that LBI might be involved in it. That suggestion came, I believe, in large part because the group of individuals who were willing to try to organize and obtain support for it were not acceptable as a corporate group in the first instance to be recipients of the property because they had no assets, no background, no track record, nothing. And the Forest Department was interested in having some more responsible group. So we really had a combination of two things. One was LBI as a known and operating organization was acceptable to the Forest Department to be the recipient of the gift and the holder of the deed. And LBI needed the assurance by someone that there would be a responsible group of persons who were willing to see to it that a organization was developed and that funds were made available, and that LBI would not be left in an impossible position owning land and not being able to have a supporting group for it. So that was the burden of the call that was made that evening. One of the three gentlemen that I mentioned had called, and they were trying to bring together a group of persons who meet at a very preliminary organizational meeting.
Do you remember roughly what date that was?
Probably would have been at the end of 1959 or very, very early in 1960. Mm-hmm. My guess would be it was in the fall of 1959.
I think it was in the fall because I remember your meeting around our dining room table. And while I was serving coffee, I heard some talk about trying to get in to look at it before the snows came.
Yeah, that's right.
Remember you were talking about going in by horseback and seeing what there was in the hotels and some of those things before the snows came and you couldn't get up to look at it.
That's right, Jim.
So
that's my recollection, too, that it was in the fall of 59. Then there were a series of meetings, Bill. Some of them, as Jane has indicated, in our home. I think probably more of them over at the LBI office. And the people meeting was it was a floating group. The persons would show up and express an interest or no interest, as the case might be, and gradually a core group developed that was willing to undertake assurances that LBI would not be left without some support. And then LBI received the gift.
My recollection, too, is that you felt that you had to move quickly because between the time the first group went in and looked at and counted blankets and so forth, and the second group went in, word had gotten around that there was movement toward a gift, and somebody went in and swiped a lot of stuff out of the hotel, blankets, pots, some of those things, and we realized that the word had gotten around and somebody had to move quickly.
Yes, a lot of equipment went out that way. Howe Sound had originally said that they intended to reopen the mine or sell it to somebody else who would reopen it. They kept a crew there, a skeleton crew, to protect the property. But they had now closed out and had left it. And so it had to be protected.
So it's just a bunch of buildings there, open to anybody.
Open to anyone. And hikers went through. And,
yeah.
And more than hikers, were, because things that went out of there were such volume. I mean, we're probably talking, for example, about 1,000 blankets or close to that, and there had to be pack animals involved in order to carry that kind of loads out.
And things like lathes, you recall that you saw people's work still in the lathes and that sort of thing, and they were gone the second time.
There was some of that kind of equipment gone too, that's right. Well, so the organization then just began to evolve, and I don't suppose that there are written minutes of those early meetings because they were so informal as to be almost coffee clutches rather than meetings of any sort, because there was as yet no corporation or no organization to hold the meeting as such. If there are any written records of what transpired in those times, my guess is that they would be found in the records of the Lutheran Bible Institute, because LBI at that time had to take action to receive the title of the property and accept the deed. And they must have taken some action at that point. And later on,
the Holden Village Corporation was formed. Of course, LBI again had to decide how to make the transfer of the property from their name to the corporation.
And there were several members at this first meeting in May of 69 of the National Holden Village Board. Several members who were from...
May of 61.
61, I mean, yeah.
That's right.
Were at the... were from LBI. I have Eugene Stein, Robert Rissmiller, Erman Lunder. Those three that I know of that were on there.
That's right.
Yeah. And so perhaps to pursue this further in terms of LBI's participation in that, on those early days, it would be wise to contact, say, Erman Lunder.
Yes, it would be.
For the information.
Yes, and yeah. Bob Rissmiller and Gene Stein also, I'm sure, would have some memory. The involvement of the corporation of Holden Village occurred, or at least it began, during the year 1960. As the winter of 60 came on and through the spring, this group met a number of times with the people from LBI, and we talked about the kind of program that might be there and the kind of structure that might be there. And my recollection is that during that year, 1960, we started drafting what ultimately became a statement of purpose and finally articles. And there were draft forms of the articles of incorporation and bylaws which began to be circulated among this group as it became clear that what really was wanted was a separate corporation. LBI was very good about this entire operation was willing to accept a lot of responsibility, but ultimately the understanding was that there would be a separate corporation and LBI would be participating in it as a participating and supporting organization, but it would not be responsible for the funding and for the development of the village. LBI obviously has its own mission to carry out, and it would have been unreasonable to expect them to run the risks and the hazards involved in Holden Village. You know, that piece of property sitting up there all by itself, needing some kind of immediate protection and maintenance, which it didn't get that first year. In order to even preserve that property, involved a fairly substantial expenditure. And part of what happened in the year 1960 was putting together a group that could raise some money and a very minimal structure. And by the winter of 1960, the winter of 60-61, we had a man by the name of Reuben Thompson who stayed in the village all winter long, alone except for one small black dog, I recall. And he also stayed there in the winter of 61-62. By then he had occasional company. Other people would drop in once in a while. But Reuben was the man who was the custodian and stayed there just as a presence. I remember we often were very concerned about him up there and would occasionally hire one of the float planes to fly over just to see whether or not they could make physical contact with him, because of course there was no way of communication from the area. Once in a while he would ski or hike down to Lucerne.
I remember that occasionally the people from Lucerne would call you and say, call the house and say they hadn't seen Reuben, he hadn't come to pick up the mail for a week or so.
That's right.
Then you'd have to fuss and fume about whether you'd send a plane in, because that was an extra expense, whether you'd go for one more week to see if he came down, and those were terribly difficult decisions.
Yeah, they were. So the process was going on all during that time, and it was primarily that first group. Most of those men in that first group had been persons who were out of the LBI board, or if not on the LBI board as such, were supporters of LBI, because at the very first it was thought that this might be an adjunct operation for LBI. I think that idea was given up fairly early in the process, but it was an LBI group. I happened not to have been in that group, and I was one of maybe two or three people who had not been directly involved, but was invited to come in and sit with them in that development.
All right. That brings us up to trying to get the thing started again, but I understand that, as you have alluded to it already, that physically the village needed to have a lot of work done, repairing damage by vandalism and the like, and that the early months of each summer season, so to speak, were spent by youth groups and other groups that were coming there for renovation and the like. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, there was a lot of that kind of restoration had to be done. For example, very few buildings had more than one or two intact panes of glass. Much more seriously, the roofs of the large buildings, the weight of the snow, which had not been shoveled off the way the mining company used to do it. There was no heat in the buildings, and so the snow collected, and during the winter it would move down to the edges of the eaves and put all the weight out there, and it spread the, are they called joists, Bill, that go up at the angle, and where the joists were supposed to meet at the top of the roof, sometimes there would be as much as a foot separation in the joists up there, and the roofs were in, I don't think they would have lasted for more than another winter or so without the building having collapsed, as many of the small buildings up in the miners' village already had collapsed. So by the beginning of 61, in the spring of 61, it must have been about that time that Gil Berg went in to live permanently, I mean regularly in the village, and become a manager of operation, both to run the village for volunteers who came in to do restoration work and do an awful lot of it himself. And we began to pick up a little equipment.
Yeah. In those early months, there was very little in terms of program outside of renovation.
That's right. It was almost entirely that. The group usually was very small, frequently living down in chalet number one, and sometimes just sort of flowing out into the others. I spent my first night in chalet four. I remember I found an old bed springs up there and rolled my sleeping bag out on it. Spent the night there. People would do that. They'd come in and they'd sort of camp in some spot. And there was one small wood burning cook stove down in chalet one, and that's where food was prepared. And people sort of ate their meals there when they worked. And it was almost entirely volunteer labor, at least during the first summer.
Where did these volunteers come from?
Largely out of the Seattle or Puget Sound area, running.
Young adults, weren't they, Vern?
No. Yes, there were some young adults, but mostly there were adult persons who would take a couple weeks or even longer out and come up. There were a lot of them built from up north.
Sort of working vacation for them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Through the Everett Marysville on up into not quite as far as Bellingham. You know, we've got a whole pocket of Lutheran churches up there.
Mount Vernon,
lots of folks in Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
That cluster of congregations up there, lots of people over there. A number from Tacoma, and also some Olympian people. That, I'm sure that was because, again, of the coming out of the LBI setting, first of all. And that's where so many of the LBI people on the board came from. As that summer went on, I'm talking about 61 now, we began to reach for a lot more people from eastern Washington and Idaho. And some of the people, the ranchers over there, and some of those congregations were very, very helpful at this point. They furnished, they loaned equipment, for example, like earth moving equipment and that sort of thing. We had one truck about this time, which Bill used to drive up and down that road at 1,000 miles an hour. Pack of people standing in the back. That was the only transportation, moving in and out. And people would come in and all volunteer. And there were very good craftsmen, electricians and so forth, plumbers. And the restoration work was done then, all the glass was replaced. And so later we did begin to compensate a few people very minimally for doing major tasks. For example, I remember we employed somebody to repaint all of the corrugated sheet metal roofs on the large buildings. But yes, and it's a very technical kind of work. But most of the work that was done up there was volunteer work.
Which was primarily cleanup.
Primarily cleanup.
Yeah.
Primarily cleanup, you're building steps back up to porches and, you know, the kind of thing that deterioration
repairing
takes.
Holes in the walls and whatnot.
That's right. Yeah. And some of the rock work was down in the street. And a lot of inventorying. It's surprising how much equipment was scattered around that village that had to be packed up and put away someplace else. Unfortunately, a lot of it got away from us even after we had people there, because persons passing through the village felt, I believe, that it had been abandoned and didn't belong to anybody, and would sort of help themselves to things. There were, for example, a number of these old-fashioned wall-mounted hand-crank telephones. I'm sure there were a couple dozen around someplace. I think most of those got away from us. There were a number of slot machines and one-armed bandits left over from the mining days down in the billiard room. And, I guess many of those got away too, but that didn't have much to do with the organization of the village. That was more recreational than it was organizational.
Yeah. What did you have in as far as electricity is concerned?
There was no electricity at the beginning. The first electric current that we got in was a gasoline-driven generator. Later we picked up another one, I believe it was diesel driven, but there were the two generators out toward the ballpark, just a little way beyond the village.
Are those still there? Or is there?
I believe they are still around.
Yeah.
That served the village well at the beginning, and then of course we began developing plans for hydro, for the first hydro project. Organizationally, during the time that that year 61 was going on, we had begun to form our organization. In fact, we became a corporation during that year, I'm sure. Might even have been late 60. Surely no later than 60, the beginning of 61, we were incorporated. At first on a very sparse basis, the articles originally drafted, I drafted them, and the first one simply said the sort of things that you got to say to be a corporation. I mean, if I remember correctly, our home was the principal place of business for the corporation, and we named a few persons who were the organizing incorporators and simply organized ourselves as a corporation so that we could accept title to the property and receive gifts and go after a tax number and the rest of the things that one has to do in order to become a corporation. Having done that, we looked forward to our first official meeting as a corporation early in 1961. And at that time we started thinking about some staff and also further defining the nature of the program that would be carried on. The original thrust was to try and preserve a youth emphasis, and arising, I think, in part out of LBI's connection, wish to carry on a program that they were familiar with, and also to involve the youth boards of the several senates. Since we were a separate corporation and intended to remain that way so that we wouldn't expose any of the other church organizations to the financial risks that were involved, we had to devise some means of retaining a church connection without being part structurally of any one of the senates. I'm sure that in the year 1960 we had already decided to be as intersynodical as it would be possible to be but Lutheran. Although back in those early days, I think we had a requirement that we would have, well, maybe not a requirement, we at least had the possibility of having members of the board of directors, one or two, who would be non-Lutheran persons. But the rest of them, by description, were persons who would come from either LBI or would be a youth director of one of the participating senates, or would be persons who were selected by, I believe selected by the youth boards. We wanted at the very outset to have directors selected by the churches as such, but that didn't work out well because synodically some of the churches structured very differently from the others. For example, the Lutheran Church of America, which was just in the process of being organized at that time, wasn't organized until after Holden had been in operation for at least a year and a half, did not have the same kind of national structure that the American Lutheran Church did. The American Lutheran Church was now organized in 1960 merger. And trying to put that together with Augustana, Lutheran Free, and Missouri Synod was just too much of a task to do nationally, and we thought about doing it regionally and rejected that because we wanted a retreat which would be a national rather than a local organization. So we decided that the best way of doing that was to have the youth boards be authorized to participate, have the youth directors be a member, and have the youth boards designate a member who would be a representative of the national group and then representative of a regional group that is out here in the Pacific Northwest, and then some other persons chosen at large.
I understand that particular part of the Articles of Incorporation, that is the membership, was later refined in subsequent years, so that it's really does a good job right now of covering all bases in terms of the participation.
Yeah, it was in constant adaptation from the very first draft on. I think that the first couple of years that we met, almost every time we'd hold a meeting, we'd do something with the articles or the bylaws to make adjustments.
Now, before we get into the other side of this tape and talk about some of the various personnel involved in the development of Holden Village, I'd like to hear your reaction when you first came into the very first time you came into the village, before not much had been done about it.
Well, the rational reaction would have been to say that there was just too much there to possibly do, but you didn't have that feeling. You looked at it and you began to daydream about all the wonderful things that might be done there. Sit around talking about various possibilities to use those kind of facilities. It was a fascinating place to be, Bill, because there was literally laundry on some of the lines in the basements yet. The people who lived there had only a very short notice to get out, and they had a limited amount of luggage that they could take out without paying the cost themselves, and so they abandoned things, pieces of clothing around.
You're talking about the lodges as we know them now?
Yeah, the chalets.
And the villages? How about the village, miners' village?
Miner's Village was in the process of falling down. There were a few places still standing, but that was lighter construction, and the snow was already doing its work up there. But it was, have you ever seen the film On the Beach, you know, the nuclear attack?
Yeah.
We had some of that feeling, because I remember in the basement of one of the places, a man had been working with wood, and he had a couple of lamps partially done. And you'd find those kinds of projects that people had been working on in their spare time, and they just walked away and left them, along with a lot of other...
What time of the year was it that you went into the village that first time?
Fall.
In the fall?
Yeah, late fall.
So that there was no snow or anything like that, you had easy access. What'd you do, hike in?
Yes, we hiked in, and that's not much, we went up the lake.
Oh, okay.
And then walked in from the CERN, that's not far
yet. Yeah, okay, went up the road then.
And the road was, of course, for hiking. It was perfectly fine. A lot of people going through the village at that time. Well, my reaction was that we certainly ought not to miss the opportunity. There's this story, which I've heard many times, about the Lutheran Church having lost one of the Orcas Islands.
The condition of the mine you first saw it there?
The mine was still, you could still go into it, Bill. The first few hundred feet into the mine was in loose dirt and rock, and so it was rather dangerous. And even the beyond that, although it was hard rock, still had loose material that would fall, and so it really was not a good idea to go in, but a few of us did go into the mine, and I went back as far as the shaft, which must be half a mile at least back into that very large area back there. You can play a football game back there in that shaft area. Fascinating to see, and again, it was obvious that the crews leaving did not know that they would not return on the next day, because you could see items of personal clothing hung up on nails here and there along the tramway. I remember seeing one little alcove where man had left his coat and he left his lunchbox, and there were still some molding sandwiches and wax paper and orange peels and things like that still there. And you got this feeling that, which was accurate, that they were not told that they were leaving until they came out in their last shift and never went back in again. So it was a very interesting experience. But mostly it was just plain stimulating and exciting to think of what might be done, and running around trying to decide what the property was really that was being given by Howe Sound to anybody that was willing to take it.
Now, I assume that the mill building itself was in fairly good condition yet, right?
It was, yes, it was. It was in the process of being dismantled, however, because Howe Sound had sold the rights to the steel and to the salvage to a private party who was coming up and hauling out truckloads of material as it was taken. When we went in, there was still a galvanized sheet metal roof over the mine, the milling area. And because of that, when the snow came, it would slide off of the galvanized steel, and the structure was still, had maintained its integrity. But after the salvager removed things like the sheeting material and took it away, then there was no way for the snow to slide off, and so it began building the bending the beams from the weight of the snow. And over the next two winters, it was a real problem for us, because no one was interested in salvaging it further. It didn't have that kind of value, and it had become very dangerous. And also, about that time, we discovered that the place where the mining caps and dynamite had been stored had not been emptied, and there were still cases of dynamite lying around up there deteriorating, and of course as that deteriorates it becomes extraordinarily dangerous. And we all worried about that, but finally got somebody in who was a professional and knew about it, all that stuff, and get rid of it. Well, there were a lot of traps of that sort. You never knew what you were going to run into. That was really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we hesitated to have very many people running around for the first few months, at least, until you could get enough volunteers in to at least reduce the hazards.
In those early days, as far as you can determine, was there a cable line going from the side of Railroad Creek that's nearest the miners' village across the water and then up the hill a little bit for the miners to get the sort of a shortcut for them to go?
No, I don't remember. There may have been one at one time, but I never saw one.
There seems to be some evidence of something.
There were power lines going across, because you see...
Well, this is north of the power lines, isn't it? Where the miners' village itself.
Well, there was a power line and a water line both that went into the miners' village.
Oh, okay.
As well as
that's
into
probably,
Holden Village.
That's probably what it was.
The power came up lake, as you know, to the area just by the mine, above the crushed rock, and then it was taken over by power lines over to the village, and to the miners' village.
Okay. Well, it must have been quite an experience for you and the rest of those. And let's talk about the rest of those. You mentioned Gil Berg and Bergstrand, some of these others. Can you identify them further for us?
I certainly can't do justice to it. Ed Ottam, Vic Nelson. I think Bill Peel was involved very early.
Yeah, he's mentioned as being in this 1961 board meeting there.
And there were a couple other persons, Bill, I'm sorry, I can't give you their names anymore. They moved shortly, and one of them, I remember, a man who was in banking, moved to Arizona and remained active for a while. Don Compan, a dentist here in the Seattle area, Lutheran Free Church, was very active at first. His wife was a very fine musician, organist, and she helped us pick out the first electric organ that went up. I think one of Don's major contributions was getting the ice cream machine installed up in the village. Don was very, very fond of good ice cream, and he insisted that the rich mix was the only thing he'd ever use up in the village.
Yeah.
But you know, it was interesting that each one of these people brought their own contribution of that sort. And very soon we began to get very competent people, especially from farms, who really knew their way around with heavy equipment and were able to do things, clearing, putting back up poles for power transmission, rebuilding, re-roofing, a lot you can imagine, thousands of hours of volunteer work up in that place.
Who was the first program person, Brian?
Well, the very first summer, Gil was everything. The program, as Bill has said a while ago, largely was reconstruction and restoration. But at the end of, after 61, as we got into the 62 meeting, it became pretty clear to us that we had to think our way through a little bit more structure in the program than that. And by that time also, we had decided to try a youth program. Our thought in those days, and maybe it was typical to a lot of the thinking that was going on in the church, was that young people, young adults really, post high school basically, college age primarily. We were afraid of high school groups up there in the mountains. I mean, afraid of them in the sense that we were afraid somebody would be injured, especially before the development, the restoration was taken care of. So, looking at the young adult, the college age student, and the youth boards of the churches suggested to us that we ought to be looking for someone who had experience working with that age youth, and preferably somebody who had been involved in one of the synodical youth programs. Bergstrand, Wilton Bergstrand of Augustana, was a person who was involved early on as a representative of one of the synodical groups. And we decided that it would be a good thing to have Pastor Bergstrand involved in the programming. Now that was to be a shared responsibility with the other directors, youth, national youth boards and programs, but Wilk was the staff person as such. And the structure that we put together really divided the administration of the village into two parts. One was programming, and the other was property and property development and funding. And Gilberg became the person who carried that funding and restoration responsibilities, and Bergstrand became the program person. We worked very hard to try and make that structure work, and it served its purpose, but I learned a lot about the fact that you can't have two captains of one ship. Both of those men are excellent people, and they really made tremendous contributions to the village. But it was an awkward administrative structure because you were constantly posing problems of priority of determination. You know, should you work most at restoration or should you work most at a program and require restoration of things which were suited for that particular program at the moment, even though that might not be your long-term program. And so it was an awkward structure to handle, and the board found it difficult to work with that. Also, I think the board was having its own difficulties in 61, 62 in trying to decide whether it was essentially a working board, hammer, nail, saws, or a funding board, or a program board. And we decided to try the same thing with the board structure that we did with the administration. That is, we really had at least two boards, and at one time almost three boards, doing different things. And theoretically, the board of directors was attending to the entire program and its development, with another board doing funding and another board doing restoration and property work. In reality, of course, much of what happened without any organized supervision of any sort. And
that's kind of been the spirit of the whole little along.
It has been. That's right. It has been.
Can't structure holding.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, Bill, when we tried to develop, for example, a long-range program, we were pretty excited about that in 61, thinking that we ought to have goals and structures laid out for a 5, 6, 7 year run out there. And we did. We had a long-range program developed and approved. But at the very moment we were approving it, we were all saying to each other, now you understand that this is nothing except sort of like a budget, you know. It doesn't bind anybody to anything. It's just a little bit more formal thinking. And we spent a lot of time at that meeting reassuring each other that we were not losing our flexibility and ability to change at the spur of the moment if something better came along.
Which finally evolved over the years to just having a theme for the year and then working around that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, as it became possible to have a little bit more staff, then the staff could think their way through what ought to be done next. And of course, one has to make those kinds of decisions. You know, you've got to decide whether or not you're going to try to continue to bring oil up there to generate electricity with a oil or a gasoline generator, or whether you're going to go for a larger project for hydro. And obviously, we made the choice for hydro. But to line up the steps that are involved in that kind of thing, permits, funding, and all of those things is something that happened only after we had some staff. I don't mean to say that the volunteers were not useful. They were tremendously valuable, and Holden couldn't possibly have happened without them. Couldn't now, obviously, operate the
right,
volunteer
right.
services. But the planning was done more and more by staff working with committees, giving them that kind of continuity and development. The board met at least twice a year in those days, and lots of times in between. As necessity arose, there were always committee meetings, and the executive committee met, I suppose, monthly during those early years to make determinations of one type or another. Jane and I remember that well because it happens in 1960, the year that the first development of Holden was taking place, was also the year that the Hearthstone was being built and organized in a retirement home. It was also the year of the Christian Witness in Seattle World's Fair. Jane and I were involved in those two, too, so we had it. That was kind of a red letter year for us.
Well, let's just get a little bit further along now into the selection of Gil as the at least the interim director, executive director for a while until finally Carol Hinderly was called to be the director.
Really a three-step process. Gil, those of the group of men that I described earlier looked to Gil as being our natural leader at that point, and Gil had almost unbounded enthusiasm and energy, and he left his own business in the hands of his son and spent practically full time working with Holden even before he became officially its resident manager. The rest of us asked Gil whether or not it would be possible for him to physically leave Seattle and move up to the village and just live there for a time to supervise what was going on, and he accepted that responsibility. And during that first summer, largely rebuilding, Gil made almost all the decisions that were made. Then we tried this two-headed arrangement with Berg and Bergstrand, and then at the end of that time, Pastor Bergstrand felt that he ought to be going back to his own church in the merger process to take care of some matters there. And the board then met, and we really issued at that time our first formal call looking to Carol Hinderly.
How did you get involved with Carol Hinderly?
Carol was the youth director of the Evangelical Lutheran Church before the merger that resulted in the ALC. And he was not the youth director of the merged church, but had gone to St. Paul to the seminary to do some teaching there. Now, here I've got to plead ignorance. I don't know that Carol ever intended to make the seminary a career. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, I don't know. But he was teaching there at the time when we were casting about for the person who would be best for the village in its formative years as director. And Fritz Norstedt was one of the people that we'd been talking to for a while, and Fritz felt that Carol would be a great person, and we heard that from some other people. Of course, some of us knew him personally. I had met him Luther League work, although I was not on the ELC, but I had met him from time to time because my brother was active in the ALCs, the original ALCs youth program, and I've gotten to know Carol there. And most of the people, I think, knew Carol. He'd been out discussing the program with us. And I remember talking to the president of the American Lutheran Church and the president of the St. Paul Seminary, and asking whether or not we would be derailing any major program that they had in mind with Carol. And they said, well, if we wanted to take a shot at him, we could go ahead and see what Carol felt he was called to do. So we did. We approached Carol and found out that really this was a dream that he had had for a long time. I learned later from my own brother that Carol and my brother and couple other men who had been in the youth ministries of the various synods had always wanted a facility of some sort where they could take youth groups and work with them in this kind of a retreat setting. So Carol really was quite excited about doing this and came to us with a lot of thoughts already worked out. And it also was an opportunity for the youth boards of the several synods to work cooperatively in a way that they could not, that the churches could not yet work together cooperatively. And I think the youth then, as probably now, saw themselves as being on the cutting edge of a lot of things, and Carol was the front cutter. And so he really came with a wonderful set of ideas and a tremendous amount of enthusiasm.
A lot of energy, too.
Tremendous energy. And, well, you know, of course, Carol's great strength of being able to communicate in the pulpit and out. And also he was able to help us because of his knowledge of many people involved in the youth programs of all the synods. And that was very helpful. You know, we survived in those early years partly by contributions, but also because the youth boards were willing to support us financially. And that happened only because we were able to interest people of real stature in all the churches who could dream the same kind of dream that we had for Holden. Carol was certainly one of those people. So were the others. The other synods.
I noticed that the present new executive director was also in on those early stages.
That's right. Elmer was there almost from the word go.
Yeah. He's I don't know whether he's listed in the 61 meeting, but if in 62 he's listed.
Yes.
To be present. I think he couldn't make the 61 or something. To that effect. Well, that's real good, and I can appreciate this real joy in being able to come back to kind of round out his service to the Lord in terms of ministry at Holden.
Well, Elmer was in the youth division of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Yeah, he was in the Wathelet program, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And that was his original connection. As was true of the other synods.
Yeah.
Vern, at what time did the board of directors or director get the broader vision of the Holiness ministry to families rather than just to the youth? That was, I know, the original thrust that the ministry was to young adults and youth of the church, but very soon families, there were lots of families there.
We learned that from the young people who came up there, Jane and so frequently true, you try to minister to one group and they help you see the kind of ministry that's really needed. And the young adults told us in various ways. I mean, some of them I'm sure said it in so many words, but largely it was a matter of talking about program and their experience. And they told us that they did not like being isolated as one particular group. They wanted to be in a church relationship with young and persons younger and older. And so picking up that notion, we decided to go for families. Another important thing that happened in there was that we got over our paranoia about people falling over rocks and running into stumps. I'm afraid that we were really unrealistic in thinking that the dangers to young children especially were greater than they really are.
They were greater up there than they would have been in their own neighborhood.
That's right. I remember the first time Jane and I went to the village with our children, as a family, I mean, sort of an official trip. We were not there for more than an hour before we were up, heading up for Holden Lake, and our children were with somebody else down in the village. About halfway up the lake, Jane stopped and said, "What kind of a mother am I? Anyway, I get into a place and a half an hour later, I have abandoned my children, I'm going to be gone for a day or two." Well, you know, Holden is that way, and it became one great big family.
That's right.
And still is. And that, I think, was probably a sort of a growth, Jane, that came out of ministering to the young people. Especially as we got down into high school age children, it became obvious very quickly that they were much better served in a family setting than they were in groups of high schoolers. We did have some groups of high school children, sometimes in very large groups, maybe a couple hundred or 300 at a time. And that was not a good setting.
No, right.
Very unrealistic, and while we never had serious discipline problems with those fine young men and women, still their attraction was almost as if they were transporting North or South High School right up to the village with them. It was too much like the setting that they had below to be a good retreat. And we learned from that. And I think the program that developed was much better. Some of the older men and women who came to work in the village as volunteers for a longer time turned out to be some of the most effective communicators with young people, anybody in the village. They had time to sit, talk, and I don't know how they did it.
Maybe and the wisdom to listen?
I guess, yeah. And they really were very effective. Well, the board and the administration developed the same sort of thing, incidentally. We decided that we ought to get out of the 50-year-old or 45, 50-year-old white Caucasian male and start opening board membership up to some older people, to some younger people, to women as well as men. And it did a lot for the board to have that kind of representation. Hardy was an excellent example.
Refresh my memory on him. I met him up there when we were up there, but I
don't know their early years.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Hardy came up, as most people did, as a volunteer.
Yeah.
And
his wife, Mary?
Yes, and his wife, Mary, and they stayed in the village for a long time, and Hardy was as good at everything, you know. He was a rather quiet person, although he could be eloquent in his own way when he started talking to you. But he was simply open, and as Jane said, he was such a good listener to people. And Hardy became a very, very effective communicator and witness of everything that Holden Village stands for.
And loved by the young people.
Everyone, that's right. Undoubtedly a favorite person of the young set.
He was the village barber, I recall.
That's right, he was. Village barber.
Among other things that he could do.
Yeah. And there were people who would show up like that. And
the man who came up and helped with the hydro plant from across the lake.
Yeah, that was a funny bill. You may have heard that story. I'm sorry I can't tell you his name. Maybe it's just as well as I can. But when the first wheels for the hydro plant started coming up the lake, this person who was living at Stehekin spotted them. And he came up to the village quite unannounced. You know, there was a taxi that ran from the CERN at that time. And he came up to the village, and he really was quite angry. He wanted to know who the blankety-blankety-blank was getting this thing up there. And who in the world thought that they knew how to put together one of these things? And, Werner was, of course, around at that time, and I remember Werner, I believe it was Werner, saying, "Well, we're bringing it up, and none of us really know how to put it together." And this man said, "Well, he did, and he knew that we couldn't." And instead of getting angry, Werner said, "Well, then maybe it would be possible for you to sort of help us and coach us a little bit." No, that was absolutely impossible. Anybody that was that stupid just deserved to get whatever we liked, and he turned around and left. The next day he was back up, helped a little bit, went away. The next day he was back up and helped a little bit. Then after that he came in and he moved in for a while, berating us all of the time, of course, about
how stupid you were.
How stupid we were to think that we could put together a wheel like that. And you know, he was right. I don't think we could have done it except the fact that he finally spent, I don't know, maybe a couple months in residence up there. He was a man who was, I think, the lead engineer at Seattle's water and the place where you go on the tours and get the chicken dinners, Diablo Dam.
Yeah. Yeah.
This guy had been this man had he was at least one of their principal engineers up there. He knew all about hydropower. Believe me, he was living up at Stehekin, and he came over, and he was a godsend, just in the very literal terms.
That sort of thing happened to Holden so much just when they were in dire straits for a particular someone.
Yeah, that's right. And we soon learned too that people really like to make a contribution of what they're good at, to have something to do. It's not work anymore, it's fun. And of course their contributions, you couldn't buy that kind of service from anybody else.
Well, it's real fascinating, and thank you, Vern and Jane. Doris, a couple words too. We're going to have to quit this here, but there's a lot more to be said, and maybe this will be the first of a number of tapes that perhaps can find their way into the portal, which is our new museum up the Holden Village, as part of the record for anyone coming in to learn about the village. Thank you again.
You betcha, Bill.
All right.